The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program, WMKV, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or staff and management. The information and advice presented are educational in nature and not intended to be taken as specific legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Always consult with your own legal, accounting, or other professional before making any investment. Welcome to Real Life Real Estate Investing, a show to help you gain financial freedom by investing in real estate. Brought to you by the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati and the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing on WMKV, WLHS, and the Maple Knoll Radio Network. And now your host, Vina Jones Cox.
Welcome, 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 everybody. Happy Wednesday. You are listening to Real Live Real Estate Investing, and I am your host, Tiffany Ray, subbing and standing in for the goddess herself, Vina Jones Cox. And boy, I'm glad you guys tuned in today. This is one of the shows that I think I'm excited about and getting to speak with our guest. I do want to remind you in looking at the email that this is a live show. We're here to take your questions. You may email them at Vina, V-E-N-A radio at gmail.com. And we even love it more when you give us a call. So that number would be 877-772-9658. Today we are speaking with Ray Sasser, and I think we have him on the line already. Ray, are you there?
Yes, ma'am. How are you, Tiffany?
I'm good. How are you, Ray? Good to talk with you today.
I am fine. There's no snow around me. I bet there's snow around y'all.
It's not snow, but it was sleeting when I came in here, and a lot of water. Just a lot of water, and I'm sure that's something we'll talk about when we get in the weeds a little bit about what your topic is going to be. But I know that you're here to talk to us about rehabs and hiring contractors and all those nifty things we struggle with as real estate investors. So let's just jump right in. Can you give me a little bit about your background and how you actually got started in rehabbing houses?
Yeah, and you know, the struggle with contractors never ends. Hopefully we get better. And if you don't take things personal, it can be a lot more fun. The way I started is, as a teenager, my stepdad worked for a property management company, and I would go around and help fix things like screen doors and stuff like that. That was in South Texas. And I got to see how that world was in the very beginning. And then, you know, we were driving for dollars. We went to our local RIA, and they talked about driving for dollars, and we found a burned-out house, and I ended up hiring my stepdad. My brother and I hired my stepdad to help us rebuild it, and that one deal just about killed us. I think if you survive your first rehab, first of all, you learn about 50% of everything you need to know, and then if you survive it, you have a real good chance. I guess the key is, how do we survive that first rehab, or how do we avoid the big mistakes that we're going to make?
But exactly.
Then we went on. Yeah, I went on, and then we've bought several hundred houses, and I've probably done over 1,000 rehabs. We've just never stopped rehabbing once we started.
Wow.
And so that's kind of a little bit about me.
That's a lot, over 1,000, and you had a hand in all of these yourself during the work?
Yeah, well, not working on all of them.
Okay.
In the very beginning, that we did the fire one, and we worked on that. And in fact, one of the biggest mistakes I made is I spent way too much time being involved in knee deep in the rehabs. And but I kind of enjoyed it. I liked doing that kind of work. Then from there, we bought that almost bankrupted us. We went over budget, over time. I remember my brother used his Sears credit card to buy the appliances for one of the units. It was a triplex. And then I used my Montgomery Ward's credit card to buy the appliances because we'd already run out of money and we're begging and borrowing and to finish the job because we did everything wrong.
Okay, Ray, you're dating yourself. You said Montgomery Ward and Sears. I don't even think you can get a Sears anything anymore. And I definitely, but the sad thing is I know what you're talking about. Keep going.
Yeah, you run out of money. That I think when you get money to do a job, you think it's all the money in the world. And then when you get to the last 25%, you realize it's not enough. And I think the real art of this is to figure out how to have enough money to do the job. And, you know, then we did a six-unit apartment complex, and I hired this guy that was a drunk, and he was the best worker in the world for a week. And then a week he'd disappear, mm-hmm. and then the next week he'd work, and the next week he'd disappear. And it's like, and then I replaced him with two guys, and it was amazing that human beings could get so much work done after dealing with this guy, because I thought he was okay, but when I got really good guys, I realized how fun it could be and how much we could get done.
It's interesting that you talk about, you said quite a lot in that intro, enough money to do the job. That part right there is huge. So I know that I've done quite a few rehabs myself, and I know about those unexpected problems and how you need to work through those statements of work. But when you have those unexpected problems that arise, like something behind the wall, or the person that skips out on you, or the worker that was really, really great, you got a lot done, and then all of a sudden he disappears you, right? How do you handle those when you think you've got it all planned out, and then it just goes awry? How do you handle that?
There's a couple of things. I realized we primarily have all mostly bought single family houses, but we have also owned small apartments. Mm-hmm. And one thing that happened is I could keep guys busy. And once I could keep a person busy pretty much full time, then life got a lot easier. It's when you're doing one and then you don't do one for a month or two, then it gets a lot more complicated, and the people become a lot less reliable. And I think also your skill level isn't there when you're not doing a lot of them. So then we have to think in terms of, you know, do you want to use subs? Do you want to be the general? It's a case by case basis, just how you're going to operate. And then that kind of determines how good of people you get and how you're able to go through these problems.
Mm-hmm. And so you were talking about the, if you don't use the skill, you lose it. So use it or lose it type thing. I'll tell you that very well may be true. And especially keeping people on task. So that has always seemed to be a thing that people really struggle with. Like, I want the timeline for this statement of work to begin on this day and end, you know, before the 4 month or before the 3 month. Maybe somebody has hard money out there and they're trying to return those funds within a certain amount of time and not pay the high rates. What is your approach to keeping within the budget and on time? Like, do you have a strategy for that?
Yeah. So I'll just tell you a little bit about my experience.
Sure.
I go over budget on almost every job, and almost every job takes longer than I want it to take. So I think if you have that kind of mindset going in, then you're not going to get too upset, but you're going to know that these things happen and you've got to plan on it. If you have good guys that are captive, sort of, and I think there's a place for having captive people, then you can control what they work on and when they work on it. And then also, because you're paying them enough money, you can get rid of them if they're not getting the job done.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think when you're a little bit more advanced, you can do that. But when you're not using that contractor a lot, it's hard to keep them honest and focused. And for example, a big mistake people make is they pay the people too much up front,
mm-hmm.
and they don't wait till the guy finishes the work. And next thing you know, the guy's 80% done and you can't find him because he got a better job or you already paid him too much money. So we got to be real careful how we do that, how we pay them and compensate them.
And that upfront budget can certainly be something. We're going to take a break right now, ladies and gentlemen. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody, to Real Life Real Estate Investing. Yes, you're tuned in to the right station. My name is Tiffany Ray, and I'm subbing for Vena Jones Cox today. I'm talking to Ray Sasser about contractors and rehabbing and fixing and flipping. And wow, a lot is going on. And so, Ray, I know that you're going to have a class on Saturday coming up, how to find, hire, and manage the right contractors. I believe that class is a mere $47 for members and $97 for non-members. And you can get more information about that on Cincinnati REIA. That's CincinnatiREIA.com. But before we took a break, Ray, you were explaining to us, don't pay too much up front. Make sure you keep your people busy. You know, prepare for the unexpected and a whole lot of other things. So right now we're in a really different market. And so I'm going to ask you something a little bit off script, but I think it's specific to what we're talking about today for rehabbing, whether or not to jump into this market. So what do you think about that the market? Is it a good time to still look into rehabs, and should people be hanging back, or should they be thinking about them differently? What do you think about?
I think I've been in four major up and down markets. Mm-hmm. The last one was 2007, 2008. I think you should always be buying. And I remember when we were dealing with motivated sellers, when we were dealing with sellers in 2005 and 2006, they were like on top of the world. They could demand whatever price they wanted. And if you wanted to buy a house or a property, you had to compete on those terms. Mm-hmm. You know, usually they were getting top of the market. That's changing, and it's changing fast. And I think there's never a better time than right now. And right now is really good because the sellers are more motivated. They're more willing to give owner finance terms, maybe do some purchases under options. So, and if you're a rehabber, you know, there's like three ways I think you make money in real estate. You're fixing the property where it will perform. That's rehabbing. Or you're fixing the management where it'll perform. Or you're fixing the money where the money will work. And I think you have to have all three skills or be close to people who have all three skills. And the rehabbing thing, if you can rehab or if you get a good partner, general contractor, whatever, you get somebody on your team that can get big jobs done and get them done quick, they can make you millions and millions of dollars, and they unlock that opportunity that comes along with properties that need to be rehabbed, or, you know, they need to be improved in some fashion. They have to be more functional, or they have to, you know, there's something that's wrong with the house. And if you can fix those things, or if you've got that right team member that can handle that, I mean, you can walk on water, basically. So, yes, rehabbing, it's a good time to be a rehabber, as far as I'm concerned.
And what was that you just said to everybody? Always be buying? Is that the terminology that I heard? Yeah, I like that. I'll always be buying. Yeah. I definitely can sit with that a little bit. So what about your traditional, I heard you say bring the property back to life, pretty much fixing something that's subpar in that property. What about the newer rehabs? Like when the property is turned over and you've got a really, really nice rehab that's gone. Do you work on those a little bit differently than you do your traditional regular rentals, per se?
Do you mean like in higher price
range? I do.
Okay. Yeah. So, yes, you've got to know your market. And by the way, we think we're the boss of the mm-hmm. of the exit strategy. We're not. The market's the boss. And so we have to figure out what the market's telling us. And if you're in a, you know, a neighborhood where there's, you know, the values aren't real high, it's probably not smart to be spending a lot of money. And if you're in the high end properties, then you've got to see what your competition is doing, and you got to compete with them. Now, you know, we for a while there when the market was really hot, we were okay with high end stuff, but now, you know, the monthly money that takes in 22 to buy a $400,000 house, mm-hmm. that same amount of money now will only buy a $300,000 house. So we have to think about, do we even want to be doing high-end rehabs? You know, because there's a bell curve, right? In the middle of the bell curve, that's where most of your buyers are. And if you're on either end, it could hurt you. And if your holding costs are high, which they will be on high-end properties, then, you know, it's probably a riskier part of the segment. So 2022, you wanted to get every one of them you could. 2020, you wanted to. Now we want to probably be in the middle road in that 250 to 350, at least in my market. And I think Cincinnati's pretty similar to the Houston market. not 100% sure of that.
I was going to say, I think you guys have got us beat by a little. I think your market's it's definitely a hot market here, most definitely. But the price range, I would say, is significantly different. The cost of living in Houston is in the median range for average sales is definitely higher in that market. But I definitely understand what you're saying. And in addition to looking at your competitors and what they're doing so that you can keep yourself relevant in the market on your rehabs, how do you decide what improvements you make and what you actually skip outside of what your competitors are doing?
So you look at your exit strategy, mm-hmm. like, is it going to be, are you renting it? Are you going to do a contract for deed? Or are you going to owner finance it? Are you going to flip it on a new loan? And then depending on which one of those markets that you're looking at, that's how you build it. You know, if you're selling a house and you're providing some sort of financing, the value, there's more value in the financing and in the neighborhood than there is in the granite countertop, mm-hmm. for example. Or if you're flipping it and you're competing with new builders in the same subdivision or, you know, right across the street, then you're going to have to kind of do what they're doing if you're going to flip it and do a conventional financing, because that conventional financing for that buyer is equivalent to cash. And so, you know, they're going to be able to shop wherever they go, wherever they want, if they're bankable. So I think it just, you have to know what your exit strategy is, and then you have to find out what your competition is doing, and then you have to be competitive. And I've even seen, like, in rental neighborhoods, because we own a lot of rental property, even in the same neighborhood, rents can vary quite a bit just by condition. Mm-hmm. So we would pull up MLS, and if you don't have a realtor, you need to get a realtor that will work with you. And realtors, once you figure out how to get realtors paid, they'll work for you very hard, and that's been our experience. If you can get a neighborhood where one quality or one condition of a house will rent for $200-$400 more than another house. So you look for those kinds of things and say, well, what kind of house do I want this to look like? Where is my best customer at? My most reliable customer. But your exit strategy is the real important issue on that.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with you there. A lot of people go into it with, oh, I can sell this house for this amount and it's going to make X, not even thinking that, like you said, the market is changing or the market is boss. Like, you know, and I really like that phraseology. That's what I'm going to call it. But you bring up a good point with beginning with the end in mind. And I know that that's something that we always talked about. Like, what's going to be your disposition? What is the exit strategy going to be on this particular property? And maybe even have more than one. You know, you think you're going to sell it for a price, and then we have this crazy tank in the market, and then you end up holding it. Is it going to rent? Is it going to cash flow? You know, are you going to be able to cover the cost of the debt with the fixtures that you've put into the property? So definitely sage advice there. I like that a lot.
You're right, Tiffany. And I think the good thing is we can predict this. So when you go to try to find out, hey, do I want to get in this and does it make sense? In my experience, there's like one of three answers: yes, absolutely, or, you know, I think so, but I'm not really sure, or who knows.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that are yes, definitely, we can, in the right neighborhoods and if the city's large enough, if the subdivision's large enough, we can predict how a property is going to perform very accurately. It's not a guess. Now, there's some places it's going to be a guess because you got a 3,000 square foot house in a neighborhood where everything else is 1,000 square feet. Well, who knows what's going to happen there, especially if it's the only comp. But maybe that's not the one to take a risk on. Or maybe if you're going to take a risk on it, be real conservative in your purchase price.
Mm-hmm.
But the good thing is we can predict this stuff. It's not like it's guessing.
Right, and I'm sure that those are some of the things that we're going to be covering on this Saturday when we're able to have some time with you over the period of time. Before we go to a break, though, I do want to introduce this because we've been talking about, is this a good time? We've talked about budgets. We've talked about statement of work, best people to hire, not to hire, and keeping folk busy. What would you say are some of the biggest budget killers for new investors, or that investors overlook? So maybe a two-part, a newbie and that even seasoned people could overlook.
budget breakers, you do the job wrong, you hire the wrong contractor, you have to fire a contractor. You know, weather can play a role in it. You know, and y'all's weather is more severe than ours, but, you know, the people work, they work on the inside first and then don't do the outside, and then it rains for 2 months in a row. You know, budget, those are kind of budget killers. Doing the wrong repairs, not knowing what your market's telling you, all those things can kill you.
So you mentioned something that actually really struck a nerve with me. You said weather, and then you said doing the inside, and it rains forever. Well, it did that here not too long ago, and I think a few weeks ago, not only did people have a bunch of, you know, busted pipes, and but people were taking on water in their basement. I think one of mine had like 2 feet. And so, yeah, you bring up an interesting concept with whether you do the inside and button up the outside first or the inside, and what the weather forecast is going to be when you start your rehab. And I think we're going to take a break. And can you stay with me, Ray? And we're going to take a break right now, and we'll be right back. Everybody else, stay tuned. Welcome back, everybody, to Real Live Real Estate Investing. I am your host, Tiffany Ray. And today I'm talking to Ray Sasser about contractors and fix and flips and those types of things. I'm looking up at the screen and I noticed that we don't have any callers. We do have some lines open. You can reach us at 1-877-772-9658 with your questions. You can also type in to the email, and that's going to be at Vena Radio, V-E-N-A Radio at gmail.com. For all you Cincinnati listeners out there, I want to give you a reminder that tomorrow is our Cincinnati monthly chapter meeting, and it's for local people and some beyond. I think we've got folk from Lexington, Louisville, and even Dayton sometimes that comes down and rock with us. But we're going to be talking about owner financing with Vena Jones Cox. So that's going to definitely be a piece not to miss. And it's going to be followed by a panel, and we're going to talk about how I'm making money fixing and flipping in a slower market. So you can find more information about that at Cincinnati REIA. That's CincinnatiREIA.com. So, Ray, I am going to take a selfish moment here. Now, I don't want for you to spill all your secret sauce, but I've got a question, because this has been a debate amongst myself and several other local investors that I talk with about these fix and flips. And it's whether to open or not to open a wall. What is the behind the wall thing? So when you attack a rehab and something in your gut tells you there might be something going on behind that wall, what do you do? Do you always go behind walls, or is that like taboo to you?
You know, the rule is if you open a wall, you have to bring everything in that wall up to code.
Yep.
So if you don't open it, maybe you don't have to. I remember I bought a hoarder house, and I could not see any of the outer walls of the house anywhere. And there was a little trail going, you know, from room to room and to the kitchen, you know, that was stacked 5 or 6 feet tall. And I couldn't see any of the outer walls. And when we bought that house, we ended up taking all that stuff out of there, and we didn't realize it, but there was severe termite damage, and we ended up taking all the sheetrock out of that house and replacing a lot of the studs and stuff like that. So, if you know, you're going to have problems in walls where there's plumbing, usually like a bathtub or whatever, mm-hmm. especially if you see there's a leak. If we try to make a house livable and sustainable and do it right, and so if we think something's wrong, we're going to open it up and try to fix it.
Okay,
and,
so that's a go for you. All right, I'm going to put a tick mark on that side of the board for you.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm looking at the board. We've got a couple of callers. I'm going to take Russ from Connecticut. Hey, Russ, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
Thanks for coming. Good. This question, the beginning of it, we're talking about how about the contractors, which seemed like you needed to have a lot of things you're working on to keep them busy, or else they become, I guess you said, less reliable.
Yes.
Was I hearing? Yeah, because that could be, I don't know how to deal with a challenge, like if you don't have enough flow, I guess.
So, well, we found that out by accident, because we had the 3-plex and then we bought the 6-plex, and there was always stuff to do. And when the guys weren't busy, we didn't lose them because for somebody else doing a three-week job, we would just send them over there. Now, some other ways we've dealt with that is, like, if you're a member of RIA, which I can't believe anybody would be doing what we're doing without being a member of a RIA. But if you're a member of the RIA, find out the other guys that are doing things, people that you know and trust, and we trade people. Like, we have a super contractor, and we're waiting like 3 days to start a job, and a buddy calls up and says, can I use them? And of course. And I didn't get them back till 4 days later, but that was fine too, because if I can keep that contractor busy, I can train him, I can coach him, he can learn what I expect from him.
Right.
And the main thing is he knows he's going to get paid, and he knows he's going to work pretty much every day. I had three guys work for me for 18 years without missing a day. And, buying a little here, buying a little there. And it wasn't like we had a 100-unit apartment complex, but we started collecting enough rent houses. So find those guys that you can partner with and trade names and trade contacts, and just don't, treat your buddy the way that you would want to be treated. Don't steal his contractor.
All right.
So that's how we've done that. And being in the RIA, we're always – now, I've been doing this 40 years, so we've got a long list of names and stuff. But if you don't have that, then you got to get connected with other people doing what you're doing, and then you got to share people, especially if they're good people.
Okay. So, in case, like, if you don't have something going on at a particular point, then somebody else in the group does. So they're consistently busy. Is what I'm hearing.
Yeah,
right?
Or either buy like a 20-unit apartment complex, and then you'll be able to keep a guy busy all the time, or get more rental properties. But I can tell you, a lot of these guys have worked on my house, my own house over the years and stuff. My goal is to keep them busy every chance I can. If I can keep them busy and keep the regular money coming in, plus you train these guys. Like with the guys I had for 18 years. I would say, well, here's the address. Just call me when you're done. And I would give them two. This is not what I would do with anybody else, but when these guys are working with you like this, I'd give them $2,000. They'd always have $2,000 of my money in their pocket. And then that way, if they needed material or whatever, they didn't have to call me. And after they'd done 50 or 60 jobs for me, they knew exactly what I wanted. Now, and that was a big argument about doing high-end jobs. When you have a high-end job, you can't cookie-cutter it. You have to be the one making all those decisions, and that's a big bandwidth suck. It takes away a lot of your time and energy, and you're going over to the house all the time checking on it, and you're not an investor anymore. You're a construction guy, and I've made that mistake. I've spent too much of my time being a construction person and not enough time being an investor.
And I guess learning some things about the construction project to mitigate stuff going wrong. In addition to, of course, paying in things in segments so they're not paid too much ahead of time, like you were discussing before.
On the pay thing, I think that's a good thing to talk about, because on the pay thing, I hate to say this, but over the years I've bought houses from other people because they ran out of money and the house sat there for 3 years or 2 years, or they lost it, or the hard money lender calls you up and says, do you want to finish this job? The pay thing, you let that contractor get ahead of you, and you'll regret it. Now, if these are people like that were with me for multiple years at a time, that's different. But most people aren't going to operate like that unless they're doing a lot of volume. But if you let them get it, I just don't let them get ahead of me. I don't pay them half up front. I pay them once a week based on my opinion of how much they got done, and we write that up in the contract. And we even have that conversation. Like, if you and I disagree, are you okay with me making the decision on that? And I have that up front, because if they disagree later on, I'll remind them, which happens frequently. I'll say, well, look, this is how much this part of the job paid, and you're 80% done with that, or 90% done. And if you're using hard money lenders, this is for anybody that's using hard money lenders. You got to think about that too, because hard money lenders almost always will pay on a completed segment of the job. So if you say, hey, I'm going to budget $2,000 for interior painting, well, the hard money guy is not going to give you that $2,000 unless it's completed. So you can't right. let your guy bounce around and do 50% of this and 60% of that and 30% of that, because you won't ever get your draw.
Oh, right, from the bank, from the hard money lender. Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and then all of a sudden he's coming in and says, "Well, you're not done with anything. You're done with a lot. You're almost done with a lot of stuff." But don't get into that trap. Now, if you're using private money or bank, line of credit, then it's probably more efficient to do it, and not to do each segment individually, but to do several of them simultaneously.
Makes sense.
Okay.
Thanks for calling,
Alrighty.
Bruce. We appreciate you on that. But I'm going
go
to go to.
Good question. You're welcome. All right, thank you.
I'm going to go to Mr. Cleveland from Minnesota. Mr. Cleveland, are you there?
Yes, I am, Tiffany.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
I was wondering if you remembered me or not.
Of
but
course.
I know you do. So this question is more for beginners that are probably listening and maybe beginning on doing rehab. My question is, when do you use contractors compared to handymen or women, no bias, on rehabs?
What is the question? You're asking me, would I use contractors?
He's saying when. I think the question is when. How do you decide that I'm going to use a GC over just your regular handyman?
Yeah. So that's a great question. So in our operation, the last 30 or 40 rehabs have been done by my son, but he's been around this for 15 years. He's, in effect, a general contractor. As an investor, a general contractor is a smart way to go, because they can take up this kind of stuff can take up a lot of your bandwidth. And honestly, if you're just beginning, you probably don't know enough to even qualify the people that are working. Now, let's say it's a move out, somebody moves out and you're just going in and fixing a ceiling fan here or a light bulb here and painting some of it, you probably don't need specialists, and so a handyman would come and play. But I'll give you an example. Like in sheetrock, the guys that crew, for example, that we talked about earlier, they probably did 150 rehabs or 200 rehabs for me. And they could do, in a given day, they could do 30 to 40 pieces of sheetrock. A sheetrocker crew, a three-man crew, can do 150 per day. My guys weren't slow. They just didn't do it enough, and they didn't have the $2,000 worth of tools to do that really good and really fast. And so if it was under a certain threshold, I'd say it's better just have my guys there because they're already doing it. But if it gets over that threshold, then it's better to bring specialists in. And you can be your own general contractor and have good specialists. And we'll talk on Saturday about how to find those specialists and how to qualify them and the questions to ask them, because I created a set of questions to ask each contractor. And if they, based on their answers, you'll know exactly who you've got and who you're going to have is you're going to have a handyman maybe, or you're going to have apprentice, whether it's electrical or sheetrock or plumbing. You're going to have an apprentice, you're going to have a journeyman, or you're going to have a master. And you got to know, because you don't need to pay that master for something that a handyman can do. On the other hand, a master is going to have the right tools. He's going to do it right. For example, if you mess up plumbing because you hired an apprentice plumber and he floods the house, that's one thing. If you mess up electrical and it kills people while they're sleeping in their bed, and it was an apprentice, that's a different problem. So it just, you got to look at what the consequences are, how fast they can go. And I harp on this RIA thing because it's real. You know, in our RIA, I know who the other guys are that are rehabbing. And if I need a specialist and I don't have that person, I'll pick up the phone and I say, "Hey, Harold, who do you think is, you got somebody to do that?" And because Harold's used that guy 30 times, I know I'm getting a good contractor.
Thank you. There you go, Mr. Cleveland. I really appreciate that. And with this, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody, to Real Live Real Estate Investing. This is Tiffany. I'm talking today with Ray Sasser, and we're talking contractors and rehabs, the good, the bad, the ugly. And you've said some stuff that fit into all of those categories as far as I'm concerned, I'll tell you. So just a little descriptive of what we're talking about. I've got a couple of questions here in the Gmail. This one comes from Deborah. She says, a very specific question, it says, I'm having trouble finding good options to replace an edge cap to a laminate countertop that has cracked and broken. Home Depot, Lowe's, Menards are all very limited options, or they're all sold out. Any suggestions where I could find or shop for something like that? That is very specific, isn't it?
Yeah, and you probably what I would do is put some sort of finish on the edge of it and paint it a neutral color of whatever that countertop is. You know, the edge of it's going to be made out of plywood or MDF, and you can sand it and put some spackling on it and paint it, and nobody will ever know.
That, or you can make it like glittery with silver or something like that and make it fancy, so it's the fancy edge of a countertop. But I do like that option. That's a good one. This one's from Ronald, and he says, I've said no to about 10 properties. So how are you finding your properties that you even want to rehab right now? So I like to really know what that's all about. So I guess people are having problems trying to fit in or find properties. And that might be some of your secret sauce, but I'll throw it out there anyway to you.
Well, I don't know if he can make it on the Saturday call, but I need to know more because I'm not having trouble finding properties. Wholesalers are bringing me properties because I know what it takes to fix them up. I would say 90% of the wholesale deals I get, we renegotiate and we get the right numbers. Without knowing his particular case, I don't know, but he could be getting bad bids. That's one of the things we're going to talk about. Like, what should you pay for stuff? And just give you a real quick example. All through the 90s, we did a lot of fire damaged properties. And I had two framers I used all the time, and I knew they were charging me the right price. And the one guy was out of the country, and the other guy was in the middle of the big job. So I got three bids. I got bids for $4,000, $8,000, and $12,000. And what I did is I looked at the time and material, and that's my safety valve. If you say, look, it's X amount of time, and the labor cost is this amount, and the material is this amount, it should cost that. And I came up with $1,200. And finally, I just gave up because all three bids were so far out. I just said, I'll just wait until the guy gets back from out of the country. He came in, and it was like he'd read the script, and he said, Ray, what do you think about $1,200? I said, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. And if you're getting the wrong estimates on your bids, you're going to walk away from a lot of jobs that you don't need to be walking away from. You need to tell the contractor how much to charge you. So you got to have a way of figuring out what that is. And it's real simple. It's time and material. We'll spend at least 30 minutes, 45 minutes on that one thing. Because if we know what we're supposed to pay these people, they'll come in and ask for that $4,000, $8,000, or $12,000. But I'll just generally say, look, this job pays $1,200, and here's how I'm thinking about it. It's going to take this amount of time, and it's going to take this amount of material. Where am I wrong?
Yeah.
And if you want the job, that's what it pays. And I would say we generally tell the people what they're going to charge us, and that's a different mindset than probably most people have.
I like that strategy. You should know a little bit about what the cost is going to be for sure. And you definitely know what your budget is. So it's just like getting really good at evaluating what to pay for a house. You also need to know if you're going to be in this business or what things should cost. So I think that's a wonderful strategy. And I like the ideas around bad bids. Say that five times fast. I tell you, I can't wait to hear more,
you know, Tiffany,
more about that on Saturday.
You know, he brings up a good point.
Mm-hmm.
We oftentimes walk away from deals, or we end up paying too much, or people end up hiring a contractor and they don't get the job done. And because we don't set out the scope of work right, because we don't have a good idea of what things should cost, we end up walking away from what should be good deals, or either we get in the deals and then the contractor gets to us and then we lose our butt on that job. And it's like, no, we really are in control of this, and we can make a difference by knowing how to do these things. So I think it's worth going. You know, Bina asked me to do this class, and she knows I'm a pretty serious rehabber, and I'm going to share with anybody that shows up, I'll share with them my experiences, and trust me, I'll probably have made more mistakes than anybody else on that phone call, and occasionally I learn from it. I still screw up, but still learning.
Yeah, understand that the education is ongoing, and as things change, we have to sometimes change with it and learn how to definitely pivot. That's one thing that I would say. And so I know we're about out of time here, and you shared quite a lot with us today. Is there anything else that you would like to leave us with as it relates to maybe being quick enough to fire people or change out folks, or any other lessons that you want to, as a teaser that you're going to teach on Saturday, anything in the last 2 minutes or so?
There is that saying, slow to hire, fast to fire. I've never really been good at practicing that, because I tend to be optimistic and believe people are going to come through, and then it ends up killing you in the deal. So we've got to talk about how to hire the right people, how to write the contract with the contractor so that we have the option of firing them. So we're going to go into the contracts a little bit and talk about the penalties if they don't finish on time, and talk about the difference between using a subcontractor versus an employee. So we want to make sure that they're not an employee, because, you know, if they kill somebody, we could end up paying for it. So we're going to deal with that issue. We're going to deal with how to keep the contractor to the end of the job and do the job the way we want to do it, and just cover as many of those bases as we can. It's going to be a full 4 or 5 hours covering that stuff, and we'll be open for a lot of questions. I think people underestimate how hard this really is, and maybe hard's the wrong word, just how many things you have to do right. It's almost like a 12-round boxing match, and if you're not careful, you can be knocked out in any round. And but I think if we follow some basic rules and don't break those rules, we're going to be successful at getting our rehabs done on time and on budget.
And I think that's the main thing. So you have a successful property at the end, so you can do with whatever it is that your exit strategy is. And with that, we are out of time. And so, Ray, I appreciate you being here with me on the show today. And all of you listeners out there, we're going to see you tomorrow if you're in person. And if not, we'll see you on Saturday. And I appreciate you guys rocking with us. Happy investing. Have a good day.